Good morning. Welcome to this presentation on sustainability potential of community-based maternal and newborn health intervention and its social perspective. And here again, I'm Rashid Shah, declaring no personal financial relationship or no commercial interest in this presentation. So the outline of this presentation is divided into three components. Initially, I will start with Projonmo initiative, the study conducted from 2002. And then we will discuss the community knowledge and practice status, what happened 3 years after cessation of the initial activity, initial project in Sylhet, and thus we will explore the sustainability potential of the project. And also we will discuss the scope of social justice in maternal and newborn health programs. So let's start with Projonmo, and Projonmo is actually the acronym for Project for Advancing Health of Newborns and Mothers, and it's a partnership between Ministry of Health, Family Welfare in Government of Bangladesh, International Center for Diarrheal Disease Research, that is named as ICDDRB, a local NGO named Shimantik, and Department of International Health of Johns Hopkins University. And I will start with the contextual information where we started the project in 2002. It was in Sylhet district in Bangladesh where almost 90% and more than that deliveries occurred at home, and 87% of deliveries attended by unskilled attendants. Infections caused about 47% of neonatal deaths. And when we started the study in Sylhet, the neonatal mortality rate was 50 per 1,000 live births. So with such context, the Projonmo study started, and it was a community-based cluster randomized trial in Sylhet district during 2002 to 2006. That was the initial phase of the study. And it was to evaluate the impact of package intervention on maternal and newborn health. I said this is the initial stage because at the latter we'll see the follow-up study that gave us the sustainability potential of maternal and newborn health package intervention. So the community-based cluster randomized trial was designed in three study arms, and each study arm was equally distributed into 24 clusters. So here are, you can see, home care arm, which is abbreviated as HCCC, and comparison CC stands for clinic care and comparison area. In home care area, we had community health workers who actually conducted the surveillance and identifying the pregnant women who visited households and visited the pregnant women for antenatal counseling. They also conducted postpartum home visits 3 times during the postpartum period on day 1, day 3, and day 7. Home screening and management of sick child was also included in their responsibilities. I mean, the community health workers did the home screening of sick newborns and managed them who refused to go to the referral facility. We had community mobilizers in clinic care arm in addition to all the home care arm activities. We conducted traditional birth attendant on newborn care and extended the health facilities, focusing on routine maternal, newborn, and child health care, and also managed maternal and newborn complications at the clinic care arm. In the comparison arm, usual care was offered through government health facilities and outreach services and private providers as usual. The community health workers were the main service providers in the study, and they were aged between 18 to 30 years. On average, they were 25 years of age. Most of them, almost more than 50%, were unmarried, and they gained high level of community acceptance. As I said before, that community health workers in home care arm, they conducted postpartum visits at home, and they assessed all the newborns and managed the sick newborns. Here is one video that you can see how the community health workers took care of the sick newborns at the community level.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to home visits during postpartum period and managing the sick newborns at home, CHW were also conducting counseling sessions at home where they covered the topics including importance of proper antenatal care, delivery care, postpartum care, and newborn care. And they helped mothers to recognizing maternal and newborn health danger signs as well as to make timely decisions. Here is one slide that shows the results were published in Lancet. That's the initial phase of the study, which was ended in 2006. So it's beyond the scope of this presentation to highlight the results of the initial phase. I'm going moving forward to the methods of the examining knowledge and practice status of the women whom we left at 2006, and after 3 years when we returned in 2009, what was the knowledge and practice status among those women. The respondents were recently delivered women who delivered their last child in last 12 months on the date of the survey, and it was conducted in one home care union as well as one comparison union. In these unions, we actually ended up in 2006. So between 2006 to 2009, there are no community health workers, no project intervention was there. So the results here are selective knowledge status, selective indicators I showed, where the changes of knowledge are reflected in 2006 and 2009. You can see headache, blurring of vision, swelling of face, swelling of limbs, no fetal movement, convulsion, and lower abdominal pain. These are the indicators we selected here to present as the danger signs for pregnancy. And the lighter bar, light colored bar, represents 2006 status, and the yellow colored bar represents 2009 status. And you can see significant level of knowledge change happened in terms of their knowledge on headache, blurring of vision, swelling of face, swelling of limbs. When I said the changes are significant, it means, I mean, in 2009, a significant proportion of women, they remembered these signs as danger signs during pregnancy. Similar changes of knowledge on selected danger signs during delivery were examined comparing data in 2006 and 2009, and all these examination exploring was in home care area where community health workers were employed, and they counseled and they conducted the counseling session to mothers. And during delivery, danger signs including prolonged labor, hand prolapse, convulsion, fever, these are the major indicators, major danger signs, those were remembered by the women in 2009. Significant changes are shown in when they were remembering prolonged labor, hand prolapse, and fever as the danger sign during delivery. Changes of knowledge on selected newborn danger signs are here, and only significant changes are shown in fever, but it is in other direction. In 2009, mothers actually were found not to recognize fever as they did in 2006. But the other danger signs as jaundice, cord infection, feeding problem, all those are almost similar to 2006, and those are not significant. So in summary, we can say that a package of maternal and newborn interventions delivered through community health workers is able to help community women and mothers to retain their knowledge on major maternal and neonatal danger signs. And we conducted similar examination of data to see what changes of practices happened in mothers comparing 2006 and 2009. And we see that it is suggesting to that the community health workers are able to help community mothers to continue recommended critical practices and care during pregnancy, during delivery, and for newborns. So what's the social justice component here? Social justice perspectives in this community-based maternal and child health interventions are reflected through focusing the community, especially the vulnerable population groups, including women and newborns. And community-based interventions are ensured to improve access to knowledge and practice to maternal and child health interventions at the community level. And community health workers is proved as an efficient channel to deliver community-based intervention to women and newborns. So we recommend to include community-based intervention package delivered to community health workers within the existing government and non-government health services in developing and resource poor setting after appropriate adaptation. I gratefully acknowledge the support for project implementation and evaluation from Ministry of Health in Bangladesh, Institute of Child and Mother Health, Saving Newborns Lives Initiative from Save the Children Fund USA and USAID, Washington and Bangladesh. And I also acknowledge the support from Fogarty Training Grant for my attending and presenting this session. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, so we have a few moments for questions. If you all have any, if you have any questions for any of our presenters, sir.
Well, I have a short question with respect to the presentation from Detroit. Did you do any pre and post comparison with the effect of the policy learning in the community?
We did, and that we looked at knowledge, attitudes, and behavior change, and that's actually in the current issue of American Journal of Public Health. There's a piece by Barbara Israel. But we didn't cover that in this presentation. We were focused on the impact, which was not a pre and post. It was more just interviewing people about what they were actually doing.
Yes?
There are a variety of things. Primarily it was curriculum, study tools that they could use, for example, how to write a media release, a variety of different strategies they potentially use to advocate for policy change. We had what we call alphabetics, that provided a lot of definitions, because when you're working in policy, a lot of the language is different, so people didn't understand exactly what a lot of those things may have meant. So we had a kind of an alphabet soup. Yeah, a glossary in the back is called Alphabet Soup. In addition to that, there were, what else was
there? We had what we call the Michigan Advocacy Toolkit, which was particularly helpful for participants, because it was basically a list of all the policymakers at the city, state, and federal level, and their contact information, their emails. At a certain point that became out of date, obviously, but it at least provided them, the initial contacts, and then I think it would help them navigate even after, if there were changes.
Did you have another one?
I have this one for Dr. Shah. I was wondering, do you have plans to do another study evaluating the knowledge in another 2 years? I'm just wondering, what the saturation point is for how long the sustainability of the knowledge lasts. So I'm wondering if you're planning on evaluating it again in another 5 to 10 years to see if those mothers are still in the room.
Thank you for your question. If I understand correctly, you asked for the future plan of evaluation, and I can say that still the study group is conducting studies in that particular area, and the evaluation I presented here is from the area where we left in 2006, but now we are expanding the area and implementing based on our experience of acceptance of community health workers and the utilization of the services, acceptance and improvement of health of mothers and newborns. We are expanding the area. So we are expanding the study, and we are more focusing on empowerment of the community, empowerment of women issues, because we think that our community health worker evaluation, not only in our setting, but in all other parts of the globe and in other groups, they have evaluated community health workers things, which is much more established there.
Okay, yes?
My question is for you also, Dr. Shah. Maybe I didn't get it right, but I think you are vast in your graphs with the percentage of women who recognize something as a dangerous thing. Two things for them. The compulsion is supposed to be very dramatic. And I was surprised that the ladies didn't see convulsions as anything. And even after intervention, they still didn't see anything. And then fever, which is also dramatic, after your intervention, knowledge went lower. So I'm wondering, do you have any explanation why those two issues were not impacted by your intervention?
Okay, thank you very much for your question. It's very interesting because we were also thinking why we see that fever got down in 2009. But I mean, we have to remember that we stopped interventions in 2006. So in 2006, we had community health workers who counseled the mothers, who helped the mothers recognizing the danger signs. And that included fever, convulsions, all others. So we had actually 9 points for danger signs for pregnancy, 12 points for danger signs for delivery, and 9 others for newborn danger signs. But when we returned in 2009 and talked to the respondents in the area, we saw that they really didn't recognize fever as a danger sign of newborns as they did when our project was in place, our community health workers were employed. I think, fever in newborns is really a key issue because, mothers may not be very aware of hypothermia or hypothermia issues, and they think fever is not. It's general. In that society, in that community, mothers might think about fever is very general. But in contrast, convulsion is really a dangerous thing. Having a convulsion is even if they don't know about the physiology or other medical things. They are really aware of the margin.
I just want to respond to that question too, because we found that in a lot of our work with CHWs in numerous cultural settings, and actually in many cultural settings, convulsions aren't, in our Western medical system, it's very serious, but in many other cultures, convulsions are actually viewed sometimes as a gift. It's a connection to a higher power and a direct influence of God's power over the infant. And it's really considered a gift, not considered a medical problem. And fever, likewise, is often just part of people's background. It's not really considered an alarming issue in many cultures.
Hmm. That's interesting. Yes.
About the West Virginia program. You talked about the mainstream development agencies that were distracted with a lot of other priorities. Did you find that certain agencies were more amenable to this? Were there different characteristics about these development agencies? Or ones that might want to even put it as almost part of their mission or not?
Yeah, there were differences because we worked with 3 different communities. And a lot of it was if they could have a strong coalition with a lot of members, so I think there was more people to share the work. So I think it depended almost on what level of organization they were at. So, a thought I have is a good part of this intervention might include some additional capacity building or ways to identify more members for your coalition. But definitely, certain communities are more advanced than others as far as healthy lifestyles, built environment, awareness goes. So, does that answer your question?
Okay. Yes.
So from Detroit, I'm wondering if the training was linked to moving on findings or outcomes that had come from CBPR research projects, or was just general policy advocacy?
That's a good question. It wasn't directly built on CBPR. On the results of CBPR research studies, but I think that one exception might be the bridge, where the bridge is a proposed bridge to Canada, and there's already a bridge, and it brings diesel traffic through community neighborhoods. And so part of the URC has a project called Community Action Against Asthma, and they've collected data about particulate matter and around the existing bridge. And so I think that some of the groups that were working to advocate on that issue used some of that data to support their position. However, it wasn't specifically designed to build upon that. It was really designed, this is sort of a first step to get some community members in the area trained on policy advocacy. And it was really built around this Good Neighborhoods Initiative. It really built on that structure, which is not a community-based participatory research, but it was something that was existing and happening in the area, and also funded by the Stillman Foundation, which funded this work. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes?
For the Detroit group, I had a question also about there's a tension in between that kind of came out in some of your quotes about trying to organize the community and the community getting focused, and the counter strategy is the pathetic 1,000 flowers in bloom kind of way. And how was that balanced by the community, and how did you guys see that? Potentially you would have had people on community self-advocacy kind of outcomes?
So I think there's definitely community self-advocacy outcomes that came out of it, especially we started a second phase of it where we actually, instead of training just anybody from a neighborhood, we trained specific groups who were already organizing around an issue, and part of that was in response to that conflict that we also saw in the data. And I don't think that that was really resolved. I think that a lot of community groups did come together, and there were all these opinions, and then also people were more experienced in identifying a program solution to the issues they saw in their community than a policy solution, and so that was part of that narrowing that was difficult for them. So you have these multiple voices and difficulty narrowing in, but that, I don't think that conflict was really resolved, and that's why we've kind of adopted the second strategy, where we go to groups who are interested in the issue, we help them, we provide training and technical assistance to help identify that policy solution and strategy to go to build your campaign. Does that answer the question?
Okay, good.
First presentation. My question is for the first presentation. I'm really interested to know whether what do you think the community health workers should be salaried, or they should be volunteering? And in our experience, we suffered a lot initially about the attrition of community health workers. So what is your experience?
It's funny that this is a question that comes up for CHWs. Should CHWs be volunteers, only volunteers? I don't know of any other profession that's defined by volunteerism. I think volunteerism is a personal, spiritual decision. I don't understand this wanting people to have to be described by that, especially the workforce. So that's not in our leadership, national leadership here through the APHA. We don't really see that as an issue. That's a personal choice, and not one that we describe going forward.
Because, different programs, this thing, community volunteers should be a key issue for getting programs sustainable,
Well, that's funny, though. Why should somebody
exactly.
have to...
why should they be volunteers for long years?
It's like asking doctors to be volunteers because it would be sustainable.
That's one of the things that we didn't want to dwell on in this presentation, but this whole initiative is about finding a way to have sustainable funding for CHWs. And that's what this is all about, is creating that pathway.
Yeah. Did you?
Just a quick comment about volunteering. In developing countries, I'm originally from Nigeria. I don't think you can volunteer when you don't have the basics of anything.
Right.
So maybe here in the U.S., people who are comfortable, maybe the husband has a good job, so the wife can volunteer. But when everybody's suffering and nobody has a job, it always amazes me that people are saying, go and do this project and find volunteers.
Right.
I also want to weigh in on that. I'm Nicole Halpern too, and I think this is social justice issues that we value some forms of expertise and not others. So like for instance, the community advisory board, we do not pay them for their consultation about the community, but we pay experts to fly from the US and give them their expertise and pay them high salaries. And so I think that there is a social justice issue. The forms of knowledge that we value and the forms of knowledge that we don't by forms of fiscal payment. And I think that it's a really interesting issue that community health volunteers are now like the front edge of global public health, but in a lot of times they're not compensated for the work that they're doing.
Yeah. Okay, another question here. Did you have a question, sir?
I was going to ask the first group if 80% would take a certification licensure in these things, how would you go about developing that? What kind of process would be
very difficult? We did ask about that, right? We didn't have time to discuss all that. But people don't want to have a standard test pass. They want it to be experiential, like demonstrating the skills. For instance, in some professions, we actually have to demonstrate how you handle it. So very experiential, not that sort of, not something that would also cut out people who have really interactional skills, but may not also put literacy and
Yeah, it was also significant concern about the governance of that system. I got too many CHWs who realize that the healthcare system in this country is fragmented and broken and not organized. And so there's some concern that that system not be the one that regulates their certification. But clearly, they don't work for
it. Probably should get certification.
So there's a movement.
Control over what the content is.
Yeah, there's no movement towards
So in New York, we're less likely to go to the Department of Education for a profession or a credential requirement because we know that they're going to want
Thank you. Great discussion. Were there any other questions? I'm sure that the authors, did you have one more?
About BDPR generally, I think for me there, I have a kind of personal conflict about BDPR and kind of the tenets of BDPR being used to build community capacity and to share power among community members, give community members a voice, but then BDPR is used as a tool for researchers to conduct research with often a very specific agenda. So I just generally, as scholars, how you feel about the social justice-based kind of movement to build community capacity, but often is used as a tool with a very specific research question in mind already. And Holly, you mentioned this a little bit, that you chose your topic before talking to the community and then decided to engage. And I don't think that's wrong, but kind of a conflict in the
Did you all have a comment about that first?
I mean, I think that a lot of people get to do DR on almost a continuum.
Can't hear you.
If you can listen, like.
Mike gives too much importance to what I say. I think a lot of people look at CBPR as a continuum, and having people engage from the beginning is probably the ideal situation, and it's not often the reality when you look at funding streams for research. But I think there are examples. I know the URC has often done this, where the question is developed with the community, and then the funding is sought, at least the topic. But then there may be a little bit of finessing you have to do to match the funding grant. And so I think that there's a tension with not just the researchers, but also with the funding, the sources of funding. But they're starting to come towards CBPR in some ways, but I agree that there is a tension. There's also a tension with researchers, especially young researchers starting out, who need to, have single authorship and have all these needs, and then that can also be a tension. So you're right, the tension definitely exists.
Thank you. Do you have a comment?
I have to tell you,
We can't, you might need to speak up so we can hear.
I've been doing CBPR for about 10 years in the same community. And initially, we went in just trying to do community health care. And I do it in faith-based communities, in some of the poorer cities in Cleveland. And from there, the next research project bubbled out of what was not happening in need, and we wrote it jointly. And then the next research project, we didn't get funded. And I mean, we had a dearth of funding for about 4 years, and I mean, but then we ended up, oh my gosh, here's another call. So it's been a 10-year process. And even though, you know, I'm a researcher, I'm a partner, and I'm at the same level as everybody in the community. So sometimes their ideas are as valid as my ideas, and I mean, there have been times where somebody has been standing in my door, and I'm talking like, it's a piece of paper going, here's a grant call. And actually, the last grant we put in September, I was counting on the pastor's door after their Bible study at about 11 o'clock at night, going, look at this, look at this. So it is a continuum, and it's a relationship. If you're going to do CBPR, you can't go in, pop in, do one study. I mean, it is, you're there for most of your career and the rest of your career, because this is a commitment to this community.
Can I add one more thing? I'm sorry.
Okay, we'll have one more comment, but we need to, our session is, why don't we just go ahead? I'm sure the presenters would be glad to stay if you have additional questions. And thank you very much for your participation.